two private organizations, at least two, exist that are wholly devoted to intensive investigation of every reported sighting of the unexplained objects. Now, one of these organizations is the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. The other is the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, NICAP and APRO for short. But both organizations are very long on the insistence of accuracy and proof before they take a stand for the existence of UFOs, unknown flying objects. Now, during the past 17 years, both NICAP and APRO have documented literally hundreds of sightings. From their investigations have come certain tentative and disturbing conclusions, at least on the part of some people. And it is these, and possibly an even more disturbing question, as to why the United States Air Force has apparently clamped the lid on much information about UFOs, and where this wasn't possible, sought to ridicule such reports as it couldn't muffle. These are the things that we are concerned with and going to discuss tonight. Across the Nightline microphone are my two guests, NICAP member Walter Webb, a lecturer in astronomy and one of the scientific and technical advisors to the organization, and beside him, John Hopf of Newport, Rhode Island, a commercial and aerial photographer and amateur astronomer and official photographic consultant to APRO. Both of these gentlemen believe there is something to this story of unknown flying objects. Just what that something is what perhaps we're going to find out tonight. Aside from all of these matters, which seem to me excessively interesting, we will get to the frivolous yet kind of fun little part of Nightline, known as the Nightline Twister. I have a question, I have an award for whomever comes up with the correct answer first. So that's the outline, generally speaking, of our evening. You will meet Mr. Webb and Mr. Hopf in just a moment. UFOs is the subject at hand, and I guess we might as well continue calling them that. It's easier than using those long words, unknown flying objects.
I think so, yeah. These are unidentified flying objects.
All right, let's talk first of all as to where your interest began in this. How were you triggered into becoming interested in the whole subject?
Well, with me, it goes back to 1951, August 3rd, 1951. Certainly an evening I'll never forget.
What happened?
I happened to be a nature counselor at a boys' club camp in Michigan at Camp Big Silver, and I took, as was my custom at the end of each camp period, I took my two best nature students out under the sky, and at that time we looked through my telescope at the planets and the stars.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this particular night, about it was between 11 and 12 o'clock at night, a perfectly clear sky, we were looking at the planets when all of a sudden I noticed this little red-orange light traveling over the southern horizon, over the hills. We, all three of us, saw this light. At first I said to myself, well, look, there goes a plane, but isn't it traveling in an odd, rather odd pattern? It was traveling in a sine wave. If you've ever seen a sine wave,
yes,
on an oscilloscope.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the gentle curve.
A gentle curve, an undulating wave. Well, it was a perfect wave like this, only it was traveling in a straight course, straight path in this, within this wave. Well, immediately I realized that no conventional airplane flies in a pattern like that. So by process of elimination, I said to myself, well, my goodness, this must be one of these UFOs that people are talking about. I had always wanted to see one, and it looked like this was my chance.
Mm-hmm.
This object we followed over the southern horizon for about a minute, I guess, and by the time I thought to get it in the field of view of the telescope, it had vanished behind trees in the foreground. So there went my UFO.
Mm-hmm.
I had a chance to look at it close up to the telescope, but
muffed it. So from there, you began reading more, and what happened?
The strange thing is, it was just a light, and this is not enough to prove one theory over the other, you know.
That's right.
So I didn't even take any notes. Well, it was not until the following summer, 1952, when I really got interested. You probably remember that one.
1952 was a big year for
We call it a flap in UFO terminology.
Mm-hmm.
A tremendous sighting wave, and it began there in Washington. And Let's see, these were the radar sightings.
Yes.
In Washington. Of course, they made the headlines, and I got very interested and excited and went out, interviewed people, and it snowballed from there.
Mm-hmm. And you've been working on it and staying with the organization and learning more about it ever since.
That's right.
Never seen any more yourself, though, have you?
None that I could really say might be a UFO. I've seen some strange objects for short periods of time, maybe just for a number of seconds, and of mm-hmm. course wish that I had had a pair of binoculars in my hands, mm-hmm. but I didn't.
We'll get back to you, Mr. Webb. I want to talk to Mr. Hopf, who is connected with the APRO organization, and for short, we'll continue calling them that, these titles of your organizations. Incidentally, both of you are sort of cross-fertilized here. I understand that you, Mr. Webb, are also an APRO member. I understand you, Mr. Hopf, are also an ICAP member, right?
That's right.
Well, now, Mr. Hopf, how did your interest begin in this whole subject? You're a photographer. Was it having to investigate photographs of ostensibly such objects, or what?
Well, when I first heard the early reports of UFO sightings, or flying saucers, as they were called, I began to think, well, probably these people are mistaken. These are familiar objects. Probably the earliest sighting that got public notice was the sighting that Kenneth Arnold made. I forget what year it was. Can you help me out, Walt?
1947.
I think that was the early
yes,
year. So,
well, I read the reports of Kenneth Arnold. He had sighted a group of shiny disks flying in an echelon formation over Mount Rainier, or in the vicinity of Mount Rainier. He was flying a private plane at the time, his own plane, I believe. And he was the one who gave these objects the name flying saucer. He inadvertently described them as saucer-shaped. And, of course, the press, which is always looking, as you know, for a little nickname to put on things of this type, began to call them flying saucers. That was followed sometime later by reports that some other people in the Midwest had not only seen this type of object, but had photographed it. Well, I had discounted the Kenneth Arnold sighting as being a mistaken familiar object. But when I heard the word photograph, I pricked up my ears.
That was your field.
That's right. I have had quite a few years in doing legal evidence photography and aerial photography, and I know what a photograph can show as evidence and what it cannot show. So I said, well, if I certainly would like to get a look at some of these photographs, I don't really believe that these photographs are authentic. Well, it was some years before I became acquainted with the organization APRO, Aerial Phenomena Research, and I subscribed to their magazine, or their little paper. At the time it was mimeographed, and it wasn't very long before a mention came up in their bulletin about some photographs that had been sent into APRO. So I said, well, here's my chance. Maybe if I write to this small organization, which at the time hadn't been in existence very long, I thought perhaps if I write to them and offer my services, I might get a chance to see some of these photographs. I did write sometime later to Mrs. Lorenzen, who was the founder of the organization, and after some period of time, she agreed to send me some of the negatives that had been sent into the organization. And eventually, I became the photographic consultant to APRO.
Well, now, let's briefly find out, what have you seen in these so-called photographs of such phenomena? Are there any that you would say indisputably prove the existence of flying saucers, or are all photographs still so-so evidence?
Well, we do not have any photographs that show any fine detail. In other words, we have never obtained any authentic photographs that show rivets or bolt heads or welded joints or anything that would indicate the material or the method of construction. However, I have in my file, or I should say APRO's file, at least a half a dozen different sets or single photographs which are indisputably authentic. However, I should qualify this. These photographs are the result of looking at probably well over 150 that have been sent to me. I certainly couldn't agree more with the writers and authorities who say that 99% of the photographs are fraudulent or mistaken familiar objects. Unfortunately, in the beginning, I spent a great deal of my time looking at out-of-focus pictures of the moon, which some well-meaning little old lady took with her box camera, and left in the camera and then forgot what she had taken, and photographs that were aborted, time exposures. Someone had set the camera up on the tripod and taken a picture of the bay with the moon shining over it, and then forgot to close the shutter and had bumped the camera and got a nice bunch of little blobs and streaks. And then perhaps it was some months before they had the roll of film developed. They forgot how they had taken it. And this is the type of photograph that about, I would say, 99% of the photographs consist of this type of material.
But it's that other 1% that you simply haven't been able to say... Mm-hmm.
I felt at the time that I joined APRO staff in my little biography that they printed, I mentioned that I hoped that someday we would get an indisputably authentic photograph that would stand up in court, the kind of evidence on which you could convict a man of murder, for example. I feel now that we have far more than sufficient evidence to prove our case in any court of law.
At least circumstantially.
Yes, of course, we have never, as I said, obtained a photograph which showed such detail
right.
that you could see how the object was constructed.
Mm-hmm.
However, the other circumstances relating to how the photograph is taken is also of great value
right.
in determining its authenticity.
At any rate, you are certainly convinced there is something, and you have photographs that prove it to you, and you are a skeptic by nature.
That's right.
All right, Mr. Webb, let's go back and talk about some of these sightings. Now, you are not a photographic expert, but you do know something about astronomy and lecture in the subject, and I'm sure you're not one of those who could be categorized, as I have seen many items in the news saying this was natural aerial phenomena that people mistook, that it's a conjunction of Mars and Venus, or the moon through a haze, or something like that, or a weather balloon. These things, you know well what they look like, right?
Yes, I want to emphasize this, that where I work, I have access to, many calls from the public. We get a lot of phone calls from people who claim to see UFOs, and I would say 90% of them turn out to be explainable objects.
Mm-hmm.
This is because the average person does not really know what is in the sky, and even familiar objects seen under unusual conditions can fool even a trained observer, as
mm-hmm.
far as that goes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I agree with the Air Force on this, the bulk of reported UFO sightings are explainable, and they usually turn out to be high-flying aircraft seen under strange conditions, or balloons, perhaps seen at sunset.
Inverted weather conditions can create...
They can.
Very peculiar...
Mirages,
yes.
They can do this. And, of course, artificial satellites. There's a whole new category that's opened up since 1957.
Yes.
But, like John, I'm interested in this small percentage, which are the unknowns.
All right. Gentlemen, we're going to talk about this small percentage, and we're going to leave the wishful thinkers, the projectors of their own imagination, the hysterically inclined, the general category of kooks, quote-unquote, and talk only about specific things that you either cannot explain yourselves, that you find evidence as far as you are concerned, and both of you are what I would call healthy, informed skeptics. We will restrain ourselves to these points from now on, okay? All right, we'll be doing that in just a moment. Jim West over here, back on Nightline on WEEI. My guest this evening, Walter Webb, a lecturer in astronomy, one of the scientific and technical advisors to the NICAP organization concerned with unknown flying objects, and John Hopf of Newport, Rhode Island, a commercial and aerial photographer and amateur astronomer and official photographic consultant to APRO, another UFO research organization. So, gentlemen, I want to go back to you, Mr. Webb. The thing that really brought me around to even asking you to come up here, over the years, I have read in the news of UFOs, and I've said, yeah, great, you know, it sounds a little wacky. And then, only last month, here at WEEI, came the news over our news wires, and of course, I'm in no position to do investigative work on all of this, of a sighting of an unknown flying object in New Mexico. And suddenly, I hadn't heard of this whole thing in a long time, and my interest was somewhat revived. And as I recall, the way I talked about on the news that night was with a certain tongue-in-cheek attitude, which I guess is permissible in the ignorant when they don't really have time to investigate it, and it does sound a little weird. But Then, in contacting both of you and doing a little reading on the subject from people who have spent years in investigation of it, I have, I must admit, somewhat changed my opinion. I am not a devotee at the moment, but at least I have an open mind to the subject of UFOs. Now, what about this thing in New Mexico? There's been more investigation since the first original news item. I gather that through NICAP, you found out all there is to know up to now, Mr. Webb, so what is it?
Yes, I might add that both NICAP and APRO investigated on this one, as well as the FBI, the Air Force, state police, and local police. This case, which happened on near dusk on Friday, April 24th, may prove to be the most authenticated landing report that we've ever had in this country, anyway.
Now, that was a landing of an unknown flying
this
object.
This was a landing report of an egg-shaped object out in the New Mexico desert. But what really makes it outstanding is that this witness was a policeman. And according to all of the investigators, Air Force and civilian investigators in this case, this fellow is a very reliable witness. Very reliable. So what we have here, then, is a reliable witness apparently seeing an unidentified flying object coming to a landing in the desert, and then seeing that object take off shortly afterward. Not only that, but he got within a few hundred feet of this object, and so close that he was able to see lettering, figures, or symbols of some kind on the outside of the craft, if you want to call it that. It was had sat down on four girder-like legs, which is the description the policeman used. Furthermore, two figures were seen standing outside of this craft. Now, he was driving to the top of a mesa, and he was trying to track down an explosion. He thought it was the dynamite shack in the area that had exploded, but when he got up to the top of the hill, he could see that was not the case at all. It turned out to be this UFO which had landed.
We don't know whether the sound was connected with that or not, but it's what brought him to the
area. Well, yes, but when the object took off, the sound did come from the object, so that sort of clinched that part of it.
What, like going through the sound barrier thing or something like
that? I don't know, really. It was almost an explosion effect.
Well,
and then the thing took off, straight up and then away.
And with this tremendous speeds, which nearly all of them, this is in common with nearly all the sightings that have been reported, that the speeds are phenomenal.
Well, they can hover at zero velocity, and then in the next instant almost disappear. They go so fast.
Uh-huh.
Fantastic speeds.
Well, then, I read in the news item, Mr. Webb, that they went to investigate this policeman, along with many others later, the spot where it was supposed to have been on these four legs. And there were indentations
right.
in the ground.
And again, now this helps add to this same report. There was physical evidence, in a way, left behind after this object took off. Four imprints in the ground, plus scorched bushes from the blast or tail flame or whatever the exhaust was that the object left behind.
And that's about the extent of the information, but it's fairly well authenticated.
It seems to be.
Any Geiger counting of the area?
Yes. I think it was the next morning the Air Force came on the scene and went over the area with a Geiger counter, but it was negative. They didn't find any increase in the natural background radiation.
Now, what about these figures seen? Were they man-like or what?
Well, even though he was fairly close, within a few hundred feet, about all he said, well, he couldn't even tell whether there was a helmet or anything on top. He just said that he saw two childlike figures. They seemed to be very short. About 4 feet tall.
This seems to conform with earlier information about unknown flying objects that have been seen over the past 17 years. Mr. Hopf, now you have been connected with APRO, and I have in front of me here a book written by the director of APRO, Mrs. Lorenzen, as you mentioned, and nearly all of the material contained in this book, which is not all hers, she merely collected it and put it here, of sightings of those who said they saw any sort of figures. Humanoid, I guess, is the proper word here. They nearly all were shorter than we think of people being, 3 feet to perhaps five.
Apparently, the favorite type is a short dwarf, a pygmy-like person. Now, I'd like to say something about this New Mexico landing. I don't have any information on it. I usually don't get any reports, any direct reports on these things, unless there are photographs involved.
Yes.
I would like to mention, though, that New Mexico has been the scene of many other landings or supposed landings. Some years ago, there were luminous egg-shaped objects which landed on one of the highways near Alamogordo, New Mexico, and blocked traffic. And there was no question about the fact that the traffic was blocked and many automobiles were stalled. And a number of photographs were taken by base personnel that were going to the proving grounds.
John, was this the Ora Grande case around the November 57 collapse?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
And
the object passed over the highway.
That's right. It passed over the highway, and nearly all the cars stalled, had ignition trouble, and their radios also were interfered with.
This implies this electromagnetic
behavior.
That's right.
Apparently there is some electromagnetic radiation from these objects due to their probably their propulsive force.
Well, now, you talked to the photographs there, John. Did you see any of those photographs?
It's a peculiar thing, or it's not peculiar. I should say it's characteristic that in this case, most of the people were on their way to work to the, what is the name of the place, Walt? It was the Holloman Air Development Center. I don't know whether it's still under that
adjoining
name.
White Sands.
Yes, it adjoins the White Sands Proving Ground. And most of the people whose cars were stalled, I believe, were on their way to the base or from the base. But in any event, the few who did get photographs turned them in at the base. And even though the Lorenzans, Mr. and Mrs. Lorenzen, who operate APRO, were working at the base at the time, in spite of every effort they made, they were unable to get any of the films. This was quite heartbreaking to us because this was a time when we knew who had taken the photographs, but being good, dutiful government employees and looking out for their jobs like mad, they turned in all the photographs at the request of the authorities. And, of course, they were all told that these photographs would be returned. You see, any photographs taken by a citizen with his own camera and film is his property. No one has any right to confiscate any cameras or film, unless, however, you were taking them in a restricted area or on a military base or some other place, which is obviously under control of government regulation.
But these were military personnel.
These were some were military personnel, and some were employees at the base.
Yes.
And I don't believe more than two or three people happened to have cameras and got photographs. At the most.
But the point is...
The point is that we were unable to get any copies of these because after they were turned in, we never were able to obtain any of them. I don't recall any specific details, but usually we have many cases like this where people employed by the government or military personnel have taken photographs on their own and they have turned them in with the idea that this is something the government would want to know about.
And may I have it back, please, but it never gets there.
Well, you see, it's private property. In many other cases, the films that were returned either were not the originals, they were duplicates, or else the people were told that the photographs were of no value and that they had been sent to some other base for investigation. And after many years, some of the people finally gave up trying to get their originals back. Now, I don't mean to say that this always happens, but we know in many cases good original films have disappeared. I don't believe this is a malicious conspiracy to take away people's pictures. I just feel that it's part of the normal government operating procedure where things go from one department to another and eventually get lost in a file somewhere. Now, I could go into other cases of this type. At one point, I had a little notice published in the bulletin advising members that if they did get photographs, to please send them to APRO headquarters or send them directly to me, and I would see that they got their photographs back within a few weeks or a month at the latest. Then if they wanted to send them to the government, to go ahead and do it. But we would certainly like to get a look at some of these original pictures first.
Right. Well, now, gentlemen, let's go back to that 1952 that you mentioned, Mr. Webb. This was a flap, as you call it, and one of the biggest. And so many things seem to have happened that year. You mentioned Washington, and I recall that myself. Naturally, the capital of our nation and any such thing that nobody can explain that shows up on radar scopes that people see and enough of them that they seem to corroborate each other. This is huge and large concern. But once again, such a thing could be interpreted as being not interested in the capital, but in the bases, the military bases surrounding it, couldn't it?
Yes. Now, here in this case, actually cases, which began in Washington, some of those sightings were later explained, and I now tend to accept the official explanation of some of these cases as temperature inversion, false weather targets. An inversion can occur in, especially in hot weather.
Yes.
And apparently there was an inversion over the Washington area just about, for about 2 weeks, I believe it was, during these sightings. An inversion can, this layer of air, can act as a reflective layer. It can reflect radar waves up and then down to pick up ground targets. So it makes it appear as if the targets are actually floating in the air. Now, at the time, I thought this was just sort of an explaining away procedure that the Air Force was following. But now I tend to believe that this might have actually happened. However, there were other cases during this same so-called flap, as we call it, where pilots saw objects, sizable objects, not just lights, that came in and came very close to the planes and then moved away. Also, jets were sent up on scrambles after some honest-to-goodness UFOs during this time.
Mm, and inversions could not have explained it.
It could not have explained these cases.
All right, now I want to get back to Mr. Hoff and ask him a question. There was a picture, according to the book published by the Mrs. Lorenzen, a picture taken in 1952, that same year, Mr. Hoff, from through a window at the Coast Guard Air Station photo lab in Salem, here in Massachusetts. Now, that picture got on the news wires and was around, and I'm sure you saw it. Four objects in that one that gave all the appearance of the so-called flying saucer bit, sort of an egg-shaped thing with a sort of a line through the middle, which can be who knows what, like a flattened-out Saturn. So I guess you could describe it.
That's right.
Now, did you see that photograph?
I have never seen the original negative. However, I have seen prints that were supposed to have been made from the original negative. I believe you could order a copy of it from the government, mm-hmm. I think for 20 cents or something, which was the cost of making it. The photograph, the print that I saw of that photograph didn't show anything which I felt was convincing evidence. A single photograph by itself of an object in the air is nowhere near as good as a series of photographs or a motion picture which shows a progressive maneuver of the object.
Well, now I know you did make extensive tests on a series of photographs taken some years later down in, I believe, off the coast of Brazil or somewhere in South America, the island of Trindade, in 1958. And perhaps, I guess, this is as sensational a series of photographs as anyone has ever taken. The object, this was during the International Geophysical Year, wasn't it?
That's right.
And there was a ship out there that was going to do some observational work, and there was a professional photographer aboard. He happened to have his camera on a tripod on the deck at the time. Am I right?
Well, the camera was handheld. He didn't
have handheld. I'm sorry.
That's right.
All right. Well, so it was handheld. The point is he was there and was loaded with film,
right.
And it was daylight.
That's right.
And someone noticed a thing out yonder. And there's nothing but ocean and sky and some rocks on this nearby island. So nothing to obstruct, nothing to foul you up in the way of weather balloons in the area or anything like that. And apparently this object he photographed at some distance, then it came closer toward this little island. He photographed it again. In all, he made a series of six photographs as it came apparently over the island, circled around some rocks, and shot back in generally the same direction as it had come, and then disappeared.
That's right.
And four of these six photographs were very...
Showed the object.
Mm-hmm.
I should explain that when this object came toward the island, a great commotion ensued among... Or no, I shouldn't say great commotion. Four or five people that were near the photographer, whose attention was attracted by this object, began to yell and call to others on board the ship. And others that were on deck ran over to see what this was all about. And the photographer's aim was upset. He was jostled. The result is that the camera wasn't aimed in the correct direction for two of the photographs. Two of the photographs showed only the water or the sky. I should also explain that the photographer used an automatic Rolleiflex, which has a crank type method of winding the film,
mm-hmm.
and I believe he took the six pictures in something like 14 seconds,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the few type cameras that he could have done that with. What he did was he realized that this object was really something unusual, and he attempted to take as many photographs as he could before it disappeared.
Well, now, I have seen those photographs and some enlargements that you made from them of
That's
the
right.
section where the object was. He
That's right.
unfortunately didn't have anything but a normal lens.
That's right.
So the object is pretty small in the whole field of view.
Yes.
Nevertheless, the blow-ups do show exactly the shape that so many people have described in these sightings, and one of them is particularly good, the closest of them. Yet, even in the blow-ups, and this is discounting film grain and all of that, there's a certain shimmering luminosity to this apparently solid material, but it has an unsolid look. And this has been described, Mr. Webb, in nearly all of the sightings that I have read about or heard, that there is a shimmeringness to this object, whatever it may be, and that it wobbles, or that it oscillates, is a word I've read used. And I gather that one of the things that happens here is that either the object does wobble, or that it's got some sort of, what shall I say, we talked of electromagnetism and the burning of the ground, either an ionized kind of gas around it or something that shows up in film that you don't see with your eye. Does this sound sensible to you
at all?
So
there are some cases, yes, of objects being seen during the daytime that way. Usually, at night, the object has sort of a diffuse glow around it, but not always. I really don't know what could account for such a thing.
Do you feel that photograph at all shows this kind of movement?
No, I should explain. The observers said that they saw this apparently solid metallic object surrounded with a glow. However, the photographs didn't show this. My examination.
They were black and white photographs.
That's right. In my examination of the photographs, by the way, APRO succeeded in getting the original photographs after. It took 2 years after these were taken. It took us 2 years to get the originals. This was due to the fact that the Brazilian Air Force, Navy, and other agencies had examined them over that period of time.
Mr. Webb, I want to ask you about some of the other sightings and see if we can get any kind of a picture of what these objects are like, if there's any likeness to them or any differences between some of the so-called reported sightings, which seem to be corroborated. And we'll get into that in just a moment. Jim West over here, back on Nightline. We're talking about UFOs, unknown flying objects. We have, I think, fairly well established through two gentlemen who are very much concerned with this, but both skeptical and scientific by nature, that there is something out there that cannot be explained very rationally. Mr. Webb, let's talk about some of these sightings. There have been a number of them. You brought up the year 1952. We talked of this Trinidad Island series of photographs and sightings by a number of people in 1958, but there have been many, many others.
Yes, sir, I have a file of sighting reports, many of them gathered while I was in Ohio, where I was born. And quite a few of them also in New England, where I'm now a permanent resident.
All right, can we sort of take a rundown of those?
There are many good ones, and I'm just going to select one here that is I consider to be a very solid, very concrete UFO case. This what happened back in 1952 again, during this flap period at Leroy, New York. And I interviewed the student. He happened to be a Harvard student, law student, just a matter of months ago. So it didn't come out until recently. But it seems that just about the whole village of Leroy, New York, was out watching the sky, watching two disc-like silvery UFOs, almost the classic saucer shape, whirling around in the sky, almost like searchlight beams, except these were definitely not searchlights. This is one answer that the Air Force tried to promote immediately, but it was definitely not. There was no searchlight beam also connected with the...
No supermarket opening that night?
Not that night, anyway.
Okay.
So they watched these two objects whirling around in the sky. Then an airliner, apparently traveling from Buffalo to Rochester, crossed the sky. It was almost overhead, almost directly over the village, when one of the two objects... In fact, both objects, as I remember now, came toward the plane, followed it a short distance. One object hung back. The one in front suddenly leaped forward, paralleled the plane on one side, jumped over, paralleled the plane on the other side. And this is a very common approach that these UFOs use when they're investigating our own aircraft. Then the object that was around the plane began to move in a series of vertical loops around and around and around the airliner. It did this for about a half a minute. And by this time the plane, and it kept going on and on a steady course, by this time the plane had disappeared behind trees in the background, and then the object, the disc, seemed to tiring of the game, came back, joined its buddy, and both of them continued this strange whirling formation in the sky again.
How long did this go on?
This went on, as I recall, about 20 minutes.
The student you interviewed, how high above were these objects? Could anybody tell? It's hard to judge distance.
I don't have the report here with me, but he was able to, he was a physics student in high school at the time. He estimated the height. This is very difficult to do, though, and he admitted that this is nothing but a guess, but they seem to be very low.
Mm-hmm.
But what interests me about this case is that almost it does prove the solid nature of the what I call a true UFO, because the object, when it passed between the plane, directly between the plane and the ground observers, it completely obscured the plane. It was as big as the aircraft itself, completely obscured it. You could not see through it at all. So this, here you have a solid, disc-shaped object.
Well, now, Mr. Hoff, in the series of photographs that we talked about a moment ago around Trindade Island in 1958, there were some estimates because it was known how quickly they went through and did the photographing again with this Rotoflex that you mentioned, how quickly you can take a new picture.
Yes.
And by that, and seeing the difference in the photographs and doing some rather simple calculations, they could dope out time, how fast this object was going, and ostensibly how big it was.
Yes.
And this was about its size, wasn't it? 60 feet in diameter?
No,
or
I think
like
the
that?
Estimate was 150 feet.
150 feet.
And the test that I made pretty well agreed with this. Of course, there's no conclusive way to determine the size of a distant object.
Well, all I can gather also is from what reading I have done that these objects are not all the same size. There are large ones.
All types.
Mother's objects, you might say, and then little chicks, very small ones.
This is probably out of continuity here, but I should mention in Newport, Rhode Island, where I live, we had a case a year ago where two very reputable people, in fact, one of them is a well-known, quite well-to-do local contractor, watched a small object, probably no more than 3 feet in diameter, rise out of the water right off Bailey's Beach in Newport, which is a well-known beach. In fact, it's the Summer Colonies Beach in Newport. It's the beach where President and Mrs. Kennedy went when they were in Newport. And this happened in, I believe it was November. There was no one at the beach. But this contractor and a workman that was there with him watched this spherical object, they estimated about 3 feet in diameter, rise vertically out of the water a few hundred yards off the beach and hesitate for a moment about 50 feet above the water and then take off at a tremendous rate of speed out over the ocean. I just mentioned this because there have been some cases of strange objects rising from under the water. Not too many. This is a really...
A rare occurrence.
Not rare. There have been other cases like this.
Mm-hmm.
But the objects apparently occur in all types of configurations and shapes. The only conclusion, if we haven't got to the point of drawing conclusions yet, but you might assume that these small objects were some sort of remote control device. It's unimaginable that the Navy would be testing any type of device so close to the shore in a resort area of that type. Every possible explanation was investigated in this case, and It was a true unknown object. There was no question that the witnesses were reliable.
Gentlemen, both of you, let's go back to all the sightings that are known and authenticated and more than one person seeing them. Now, I wanted to ask you, Mr. Webb, was the pilot of that plane ever contacted? Did he see this object?
Well, I've been asked this. First of all, it's very interesting here. They, in the local Leroy, New York newspaper, they published the sighting, but they did not mention anywhere anything about the objects coming up and loop the loop around the airplane. I can't really account for this. You would think that at least one or two passengers in the plane would let the word leak out that a sighting had been made.
Well,
any point on that?
The problem there, the airlines are understandably reluctant to publicize any reports that their planes are being buzzed by any unknown devices. I think the airlines have enough problems with normal accidents without encouraging the idea that their they're a source of investigation by unknown craft of any type.
I can see that. Well, now, generally speaking, then, various kinds of objects apparently have been identified by witnesses. There have been the saucer shapes, and this is the most popular version. There have been the long cigar-shaped affairs, and there have been round globes, which seem to hover over cars and stop their ignitions, as you mentioned. This has happened to railroads. Planes have had trouble. There have been many pilots to report that their whole electrical systems went out in seeing some such thing, and then only in the nick of time does it come back. Some planes have been lost completely unexplainably. Whole squadrons of planes have disappeared, where there's been a rise in magnetic activity. All of these things tend to, in a peculiar sort of way, corroborate one another, or at least lead to similar questions. Am I overstating the case here?
Well, that's quite correct, and as you mentioned, there seem to be quite a variety of types of these UFOs.
All right, gentlemen, we're just about time to get up to the news. Immediately after the news, I want to go into one other matter, and I think you had some concern with this, Mr. Hoff, or at least know something about it. Perhaps you do too, Mr. Webb. Of one object that was seen to get into trouble and explode down over Brazil, and chunks of this object, made of whatever, fell into a lake, and they recovered some of these pieces, and there have been numerous tests done on them. And I want to get into what that test showed, perhaps some conclusions that we can make very early and without all of the information that both of your organizations certainly have on file. And then we want to open up the phones to anybody who has any other stories, and I suppose you would welcome this. Maybe we can add to the file of both NICAP and APRO. And this is something I know you're both looking for. And questions or comments or curled lips, we're open to them all. So we'll see you in five. Meantime, the magic word is UFO. Unknown flying objects. Are they real? Are they imaginary? My two guests this evening, Walter Webb and John Hopf, both believe, though they are natural skeptics, but also they're scientists in their fields, one a professional photographer, the other a lecturer in astronomy, both very much interested in the subject, and they believe there is something out there that has not been adequately explained. We've been talking about this for some time here on Nightline, but right now we want to get to some facts. Now, Mr. Hopf, I believe it was in 1957 that a most unusual occurrence took place down in Brazil at a place known as Ubatuba. I think I'm pronouncing it right. U-B-A-T-U-B-A. Looks like Ubatuba, but I guess they say Ubatuba.
Something like that.
Apparently, an unknown flying object, a flying saucer, attempted to make a maneuver that was even a little too much for them and exploded not very far above a beach and a lake, and pieces of this object fell down and were recovered. Great tests were done by those, by physicists and chemical analysis and radiological analysis, and I don't know what all.
Metallurgists
and so forth, and a very scientific investigation that took quite some time, and they made more than one test. And what was proved that this material was made of?
Well, a series of tests were made by the Brazilian Mineral Resources Board, which had some excellent laboratory facilities. They made a number of spectroscopic tests on two or three different types of machines, and the results were very conclusive that this material was magnesium of a purity beyond what we consider laboratory standard. And at that time, I don't believe that any, in fact, I know no metal fabricating plant in the world would have made metal of this purity in a quantity that would be required to build any sort of a flying device. Of course, there'd be no sense in making, as far as we could see, in making any sort of flying machine out of pure magnesium.
First of all, it isn't the strongest thing in the world.
That's right.
And has all kinds of qualities that we would consider absolutely impossible.
Well, it's quite ridiculous to make anything out of magnesium of almost 100% purity. The most refined tests that were conducted on this material by the Brazilian Mineral Resources Board failed to show any impurities. The purity was beyond any laboratory standard samples that they had. I understand that recently additional tests were made in this country by a number of are by at least two laboratories, one laboratory of the Atomic Energy Commission, and another one by an independent chemical company laboratory. And these tests confirm the findings of the Brazilian laboratories, that this material was definitely not a man-made material. Now, I'm not a metallurgist. I'm really out of my field here. However, I talked to Dr. Fontes. He came here to Boston to meet me a year ago.
That is a scientist in Brazil who is also interested in unknown flying objects.
I'm sorry, we hadn't gotten into that. But Dr. Fontes followed through these reports and tests very exhaustively. And after talking with him, I was completely convinced that there was no question of the fact that these tests were authentic and indisputably accurate.
And consequently, this material seemed to show that it had an extraterrestrial, I can never say that word.
There wasn't any question that this material... Now, if you like, I could go into the what happened when we sent samples of this material to the United States government.
Yes, what did?
Do you want to go into that now?
Sure.
One sample was sent to the United States Air Force, and this sample was accidentally burned up in the spectroscope due to some error of the operator. I'm not familiar with the operation of the spectroscopic machines, but another sample was then requested, and this second sample, am I right here, Walter? The second sample was tested in a contaminated machine. In other words, in order to determine... in order to determine the purity of a material.
The electrodes themselves enter into it.
Well, it seemed that a previous test had been made in the machine and the fragments, the machine had not been correctly cleaned, you see. In order to detect impurities of a very fine degree by a test of this type, the machine must be completely cleaned in a manner that's completely beyond our ordinary standards of cleanliness.
So what you're saying is that the second test
was inconclusive. It showed traces of materials that were the result of the fact that these materials had been left in the testing apparatus.
Right.
The Air Force then requested more samples, and of course we drew the line here. I don't know how many pieces of this material are still on hand, but I know we had a number of fragments.
But it was completely pure magnesium.
Yes, the various tests that have been made certainly show this.
All right. Now, getting back to you, Mr. Webb, let's talk a moment. We have not given every case that's available, and obviously we don't have the time. What conclusions can be reached logically without overextending ourselves on these unknown flying objects, the fact of this magnesium not being of a purity that nobody's made to anybody's knowledge here on Earth, or that they're incapable of making, or if so, it's so expensive, it's foolish.
That's right.
What conclusions can be met here at all? The fact that there seems to be some connection between these unknown flying objects and electromagnetic forces of some sort, that the objects themselves, if one looks for a pattern, one seems to emerge. What does that pattern look like to you and others who've studied it?
Well, of course, we're all interested in trying to figure this out. There are patterns, of course. They're very difficult to determine many times. I've been looking for concentrations of activity here in the New England area.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, for reasons unknown to me, I have not been able to discover this yet, but there seems to be quite a concentration of UFO activity in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. I'm in the process now of going back in the past 10 years, taking all the sightings in New Hampshire and seeing where they fall on a map.
And trying to see why this might be. Now, one theory advanced by the APRO people, with whom Mr. Hopf has more of a connection, or you're a member too, is that these have come in waves over 2-year periods as a rule, though not always, and that apparently some of the early UFO appearances had to do with geographical mapping of our nation and other places in the world, South America, the Orient. France, England underwent all of this. Even some have filtered out of Russia and behind Iron Curtain countries.
Well, of course, it would be logical for any, if you take the extraterrestrial theory here, that they might be extraterrestrial spaceships, might be quite logical
mm-hmm.
for a scientific party from another world or worlds to want to know all possible about the world that they're exploring. Of course, one of the many things they'd be doing would be to map the planet.
Well, why so many sightings near air bases? This seems to be more true than not in many of them. It leads one to suspect. Am I being unduly suspicious, or is this
a
pattern, too?
Well, there does seem to be some pattern there. There are quite a few reported sightings over air bases. Cape Kennedy, for example, White Sands. I suppose this is one way of getting an idea of what the technology of the planet civilization is like.
Would you say that the behavior of any of these, it has been said by Mrs. Lorenzen, who wrote this book, for which I've been mentioning from time to time tonight, that these objects appear hostile in any sense? Would you say that that generally comes through to you, Mr. Hopf?
I don't agree with that. There's no doubt that there have been some authentic cases where people have been injured by the action of these objects. However, I like to feel that any injury they've done us has been accidental and due to the fact that we couldn't get out of their way or they couldn't get out of ours. The loss of aircraft that has been connected with these objects, of course, has never been conclusively proved, but as I say, I like to feel that they don't mean us any harm, but some of the collisions and accidents that have occurred may have been due to the fact that the devices were remote controlled in some manner.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we're now getting into theorizing about
right.
what their intentions would be.
Well, while we continue this theorizing, may I make a suggestion to our Nightline listeners here on WEEI? If you have any information on this, if you yourself have any feelings on the matter or any beliefs or certainly experiences, mostly experiences, but indeed any interest in this, we invite your calls and comments. 338-6700 is our number. So we might as well make it a party here and find out what this UFO thing is all about, and you can add to it. So we invite you, 338-6700. Let's theorize for just a moment. You gentlemen have looked at a great deal of material here. Can you carry on any theories that seem tenable to you, Mr. Webb?
Yes, I have accepted the idea that some of these UFO sightings, anyway, seem to indicate extraterrestrial spacecraft from another planet or planets. In fact, I don't go along with those that think that there might be one world involved. The great variety of shapes and sizes and to these things seems to indicate perhaps several races involved here.
Well, would you say, now, from what all we know about space at the moment, interplanetary travel seems to take a long time. Would you say that each one of these invasions, if that's what you can call it, flap, let's use your word, comes all the way from another planet or maybe even another galaxy? Or have they established, perhaps, assuming now that these things exist, have they established a base, like, let's say, on the moon? Or have they themselves got some sort of artificial satellites traveling around either one of the planets or some such?
Well,
what would you think?
It's quite possible. We have no definite proof of this, but it seems very logical if for any race or races from another world or worlds, again, investigating this particular third planet from the sun, which is the Earth, that they might want to establish a base without being seen by the inhabitants of that planet. And a very good place to do it would be, let's say, on the far side of our own natural satellite. The moon that goes around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
On the far side, they could remain hidden there. Of course, this remains to be seen because in coming years, the United States and Russia, as far as that goes, are planning space probes. And these probes are going to be able to take more detailed pictures as the years go on.
I see. Well, we have a call from a Nightliner. Let's see what it's all about. I think I heard his name is Mr. Blip. Sounds like he's connected to some radar. Flip, maybe? Well, hello, sir.
Hello.
What is your name?
Flint, F-L-I-N-T.
Oh, Flint. You know, it sounded like Blip to me, but that shows what kind of a program we're on tonight. Okay, Mr. Flint. Go right ahead.
Well, I'd like to ask the gentleman there is that why, I've been listening quite some time, and I was wondering why they never get onto the subject of this ball lightning, which is an article that appeared in one of the newspapers here by Mr. Menzies.
Mm-hmm.
And he went on to tell about this chain lightning, which seems to have separated itself. The ball lightning seemed to, maybe that nature has found a way of separating it from the is plasma.
All right, well, fine. Mr. Hopf is nodding his head as if he knows what you're talking about. I don't, so go ahead, Mr. Hopf.
The ball lightning is another unexplained phenomena. To those listeners who have never heard the term before, the phenomena consists of a luminous ball of usually a small size, sometimes only a few inches in diameter, which will enter usually during an electrical storm and travel throughout the house, and very often will pass out an open door or window without doing any harm. However, occasionally, if it bumps into something, it may cause an explosion. And there have been many, many absolutely authentic but very weird reports of this phenomena. I don't feel this has any connection with UFOs. I just feel it's another one of the many unexplained...
electrical phenomena.
Well, not just electrical. It's a phenomena connected with many other unexplained phenomena. I don't want to say that it's electrical because perhaps this phenomena is not really electrical.
Yeah. It seems, though, that some of the after effects from both are very much alike.
Yes, well...
The ozone, the smell of ozone.
Yes, well, the feeling I have, which I haven't had a chance to express yet, is that so many unexplained phenomena may be related in a way unknown to us. I feel that our scientific knowledge is in its infancy, and I know a lot of scientists will be greatly hurt by this opinion, but... perhaps someday we will learn the connection between many phenomena, which will include UFO.
Well, Mr. Flint, it's nice that you called. We'll have other Nightliners here. Let's see if they have experiences that can either help explain what you brought up or other matters.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. I'll be listening.
Okay. Mr. Stone is with us, and we'll get to him in just a moment. Mr. Stone, you're on WEEI's Nightline. Go right ahead.
All right. I was going to ask two questions. The first was going to be dealing with ball lightning, but that's been preempted already.
Right.
And the second was going to be a question about the weight and size of the magnesium sample referred to in tonight's conversation.
All right. Mr. Hopf, I think, has that.
I don't have the figures right in front of me. I believe these samples were varied from... a fraction of an inch to 2 or 3 inches in size.
All right.
I'm not sure of the weight.
Okay, now you made some statements about it not being man-made.
Yes.
Well, you can make metals or semiconductors or anything you want of almost unlimited purity nowadays in laboratories in ultimately very large quantities. So
yes.
I don't see what... how you can come to the conclusion about its man-made nature or non-man-made nature.
Well, I realize that metallurgical science has improved quite a bit in the last few years. However, at the time of this sighting and at the time these fragments were picked up, no one in the world, to our knowledge, either had the facilities or the need or the desire to make pure magnesium in a quantity that would be required to make a flying device.
Okay, now what was the year?
1957, wasn't it, Mr.
Hopf? That's right.
Okay, and can you give an estimate of any purity estimate at all of the magnesium?
Well, let's see. The entire report's right in front of me, but I don't know whether I can take the time to go through the entire report. As I say, I'm not a metallurgist.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'd recommend that you get a copy of the book, which has an exhaustive treatment of it. The title of the book is The Great Flying Saucer Hoax,
mm-hmm.
published by William Frederick Press,
yes.
New York. And any book dealer can get this for you. If you're interested in this angle, I'd recommend that you get it. The metallurgical report itself occupies certainly 50 or 60 pages.
I think I have just found one thing here that maybe I can give you. This one report, sir, Mr. Stone.
Yes.
An emission spectrograph test showed the presence of trace elements to this amount. Now, wait a minute. That's the one about... Oh, excuse me. That's the one here in the United States. That one was no good.
Why was it listed as contaminated?
Because of the electrodes, I guess.
Well, no tests were made by the government in this country that were properly conducted.
Okay, now, who says that these things were not properly conducted? What is the criterion? In other words, you were about to quote an emission spectrograph reading.
Yes, I was looking at the wrong one, sir. I'm sorry.
All right, then let me go. This seems to be, to my mind, something foggy about this. You mentioned in the course of your conversation that the AEC had performed tests on the magnesium. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Recently.
Oh.
The original tests performed under Air Force auspices were aborted for one or two reasons. In one case, they burned up the sample accidentally, and the or I should say the sample was destroyed before the test could be properly set up. I'm not sure what the procedure is to test metal samples,
mm-hmm.
but the sample was destroyed accidentally. In the second test, it was discovered after the test was completed that the machine was contaminated with the results of a previous test.
All right. Now, what laboratory did that? What Air Force laboratory?
I'm not sure, but it was conducted under official government sponsorship.
Okay. Can you mention perhaps what the results of the AEC tests were?
Well, this gets a little complex.
More recent tests confirmed the three Brazilian tests, which were made independently of each other for in order to determine no bias.
That there were, and what were the results of these?
They confirmed the fact that this material was of a purity greater than the laboratory standard for pure magnesium.
Oh, okay, fine. That's something definite.
I hesitate to go on any further with these details because no one's a specialist up here. The only thing is, this is a very exhaustive treatment of this with all of the tables and all kinds of tests that I can't read. Only a specialist and a scientist in this field would really understand.
Well, I'm in solid state. So
yeah. Well, this would be right up your alley. You'd even be able
to... I'd like to break in here. Apparently, this man's an expert on metals. I have had these tests examined by a number of metallurgists,
mm-hmm.
and including some connected with the government in Newport, and their opinions are conflicting. In other words, it's possible for different people to interpret these tests in different ways. I'd certainly recommend that you get a copy of the original book.
I think you keep yourself fascinatingly occupied for at least a full day, maybe more.
All right.
Okay,
Mr.
Stone.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for calling. Miss Q, gentlemen, is on our WE Nightline right now. Hello, ma'am.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
Oh, am I on?
You sure are.
Oh, well, that's fine.
It's a long wait, but it was rewarded.
Well, I can hear them out the other way here now.
You what?
What, is this on tape?
You turn off your radio, and you'll do much better.
All right, just
yes,
a
there's
second.
A delay here, and you'll only confuse yourself. So while she's gone, we will wait for them.
I'm sorry.
Ah, there you are. Good.
I don't know if this is of any interest to them, but this was back in the early, must have been 1953 or 4. And I was sitting, it was daylight saving time, and it was somewhere between the 17th of June and the 4th of July. And we saw this, an elliptical green shape with like a glow to the edge of it.
Where was this?
We were sitting in Saugus. Now, we didn't think anything of it except that we thought they were either early with the fireworks for July or late for the 17th of June. And a couple of years later, I read The Flying Saucer Conspiracy by Kehoe, and I've been trying to go through this book now to find the reference, and it did mention a sighting over New Hampshire at that time. And I was wondering if either of your gentlemen knew about it, or was that just something that was disproved?
What do you know about that, Mr. Webb, anything?
I've been racking my brain.
I've been flipping through the book, and I can't, it's just too much to look up in such a hurry. I didn't know you were going to be on.
Yeah, it seems to me I am a rather recent resident of New England, and sightings previous to 1957 I know very little about. But somewhere in the dim past, I remember something about this Saugus case. You say you've had a hard time looking up the clippings?
Saugus, but this book by Kehoe seemed to indicate that New Hampshire had seen this same elliptical green thing, and I never forgot it. It was so unusual. And it was daylight saving. I know it was after supper, but it was still bright,
mm-hmm.
so it wasn't searchlight or anything like that.
Well, did it? Did you get the impression that it was solid?
No, I didn't get that impression. And as I say, having read this Kehoe thing, if it was at that distance,
mm-hmm.
you see, we were looking in the right direction, because that was all hindsight. Having read about it much later.
I don't want to take up too much of your time here on the phone line, but I'm very interested in this case. Could you just briefly tell me a little bit about the maneuvers of this object?
Well, that's just it. It wasn't there that long, and as I say, we thought it was a firework of some sort that they were maybe planning for the 4th of July. As I said, it was between the 17th and June when we do have fireworks here in Boston. Mm-hmm.
I tell you what, Miss Q, would you mind giving us your phone number? And I'm sure Mr. Webb would maybe want to call you a little later and find out as much as you remember about this and then to see if it corroborates any other things they have in their files.
I'd like to. That's all.
So I suppose, why don't you hang on the phone?
Yeah.
Our producer will take your number. We'll give it to Mr. Webb later and he can contact you, all right?
That's fine.
Fine, thank you.
I'd like to show Mr. Webb.
We'll be talking to Mr. Irian here on our WEEI Nightline in just a moment. Hello again. Jim Westover on WEEI's Nightline. I have two guests who believe that there are such things as unknown flying objects, that they have definitely been proved, that there is something out there that is doing reconnaissance work against the Earth, or at least over the Earth. Question, why? I have Walter Webb, I have John Hopf, and both of them are very serious about this, and they take a rather curved-lip attitude towards the, the contactee element, or the cultists, or those who believe they have been talked to by little green men or given messages of great import. This is not what we're looking for. We are looking for stories that seem to substantiate things which cannot be explained any other way except in some term of reference of extraterrestrial objects from somewhere else with some intelligence guiding them and having built them. Gentlemen, before we go on, Mr. Williams is waiting on the line. I hope you'll be patient for a second. I want to talk a little bit about your organizations, APRO and NICAP. Why are you doing all of this, getting all this information, going to all this trouble? There's no money in it for you. This is merely a matter of interest and scientific observation. What is APRO working toward, Mr. Hopf?
Well, I thought you were going to ask Walt first, but...
Well, he's been talking so much, I'll give you a chance.
So many people say, well, what good is all this? Why do you bat your brains out? Look at all the time you waste on this, which is true. I've spent a lot of time analyzing photographs, and as I said before, the great majority of them turn out to be mistaken, ordinary objects or photographs that are blurred or defective. However, all this, it's worth it to come across occasionally a good, authentic photograph. The underlying purpose behind so many people working on the subject is the hope that, this is sort of a forlorn hope now, at one time we in APRO felt that our little voice, and it certainly is small, we only have around 2,000 members, but they're distributed throughout the world, we hope that our members, our active members, would be able to communicate a serious attitude on the subject to the general public. And I know this sounds like a very lofty idea and quite impractical, but we had hope that our few voices would reach enough influential people who could join us in spreading the word that there certainly is more than enough evidence to show that we are being watched or visited, if you prefer, by some form of intelligent life. And by a process of elimination, we long ago came to the conclusion that these objects must be operated by a superior technology.
You still have this purpose, don't you?
Yes, but I'm afraid that the hundreds and thousands of groups that have sprung up throughout the world that have made a cult and in some cases a real religion out of the UFO question, I'm afraid that we have been simply overwhelmed by the tremendous number of people that seem to have a need to develop some new type of religion, which is what it is really. Many groups are frankly religious.
Well, now, Mr. Hopf, I hope that this program tonight and your being on it and Mr. Webb's shows you that at least I'm serious about this, and I hope that this has been a small voice, and maybe not so small, in giving some of your original and I hope not too tarnished beliefs in what you were doing. Mr. Webb, how about NICAP? Is it looking toward something of the same matter as APRO, or has it got a little different viewpoint?
Well, I think it is a shame that these fan clubs, these little cult groups, have confused the issue, if I may put it that way. There are serious groups around, and I think the two that come to mind, of course, are APRO and NICAP. As for NICAP, it has two goals, really, that I can think of. One of them is a congressional investigation of the Air Force investigation.
As to why it's been so bottled up and
two-faced. As to why everything's bottled up, and it seems that these serious civilian groups like APRO and NICAP arrive at one conclusion and the Air Force arrives at another, at least publicly. And we get the impression that there are facts and information that's being withheld from the public. So perhaps we hate the idea, but perhaps the only way to do it would be to attempt a congressional investigation.
Well, some congressmen have shown a great interest in this.
They have shown a tremendous interest in it, and I think that NICAP does have the backing. If I may say this, NICAP is about ready to publish a report called the UFO Evidence, and it's a summary of 7 years of NICAP investigations. They will include a lot of sightings in this report, and it's due to come out early next month. We think this could be the spark. We hope that it will be the spark to for Congress to get on the ball here with a possible investigation. Now, that's one goal. Through this means, perhaps a scientific investigation would be the next step. But I think that it's got to be gotten out into the open first, and perhaps this NICAP report will do this. When it gets out, when the public realizes that there's something behind this secrecy that's going on, something behind the UFO story, as far as that goes, and then the interest may be generated, and we can hope for a scientific investigation.
Good. Well, I wanted you to at least state what the two organizations were trying to do. Yes, Mr. Hall.
I can't help but comment on what Walter has said. I agree completely with the purposes of NICAP. I don't want people to get the impression that I'm opposed to them. I'm a member of NICAP, and I've supported them financially, and I certainly hope that they could get a congressional subcommittee to investigate. However, I don't think this will ever come about because there are too many skeletons in the closets of the military and the Pentagon. I think that Pentagon must have 50 million closets in it. I'm afraid that any sort of an investigation that was conducted by Congress would be conducted 100% behind closed doors. The few little inquiries that Congress has held, a few subcommittees have held investigations on this subject in the past, and the only speakers who testified at these hearings, I've said this backwards, the only statements that were released to the press from these hearings were statements of Air Force spokesman.
Mm-hmm. With the public attitude that we've already become familiar with.
That's right. And I don't give any hope to the idea that Major Kehoe has. It's a wonderful, glorious crusade.
Well, then you must believe,
but
Mr.
I don't believe that he'll ever get a congressional investigation.
You must believe. Your view is a little more cynical, perhaps, than Mr. Webb's, but then you're a little older than he is.
I think I've been in the thing a little bit too long, maybe. I'm honestly weary of butting our heads up against a stone wall. We have never been able to get any coherent policy statements from the government on this subject.
Well, you must believe then, sir, that this whole investigation of UFOs, or the whole evidence such as it exists, is one which is either so secret or has such terrifying, at least in the opinion of some of our governmental leaders, perhaps
military.
Glad you said
that.
Implications that it's that they feel that for our best interest they must keep it bottled up. Of course, I'll take issue with who should decide my best interest, and I gather you feel the same way.
Well, one of the theories, and at one time it was my favorite theory, is that the reason the government has gone to great lengths to discredit authentic witnesses and to ignore some of the authentic evidence that we have is that if the real truth about the UFO situation is simply too horrible to make public. And this is a very sad conclusion I have to come to, but I don't know what other conclusion you can reach. I hate to feel that the whole thing is being concealed because the government has made such a botch of the whole thing that they hate to have the truth come out of the mishandling of this subject.
But, gentlemen, it isn't just our Congress who can be concerned. These sightings have been all over the world, and there are
That's
other
right.
Congresses and there are other governments. Now, is there any hope here?
Well, possibly. I might mention that, in fact, the Brazilian Air Force back in 1954 and this is in direct contradiction with anything that's been released by our own Pentagon in this country, they held a press conference and released three tentative conclusions at that. Now, remember, this is back in 1954. They have since changed their tune a little bit, I think, and closed down just as the U.S. Air Force has done.
But when they were speaking openly, they said what?
Here are their three conclusions. They concluded that, one, the UFOs were real. Number two, they were revolutionary aircraft of some sort. And number three, that the origin was unknown. Now, they don't come right out and say that they're spaceships from another planet, but they are hinting at it. And this is certainly a step in the right direction. But you see, something's happened. Even the Brazilian Air Force has closed the lid down.
Yes. Gentlemen, thank you for at least making clear some of your thoughts about what this means, and I apologize to those of you who are on the phone and waiting, and we're going to get to you right away, but we do have a little message for you first.
I have been thinking about a thing for a long time. Since molecules vibrate, now I was thinking if a creature or a thing from outer space would vibrate at a different speed, could it be possible for this thing to not only be invisible to us, but to be in the same space as something on Earth?
Well,
you know what I mean?
That gets into that antimatter again, doesn't it, Patrick?
Well, sort of.
There isn't any doubt that there are many unknown things in this world, in this universe. However, you could speculate on almost any type of a creature. However, there's never been any proof that there is any type of life except the type that we know. We don't have any evidence at all as to what type of creature or intelligence operates these UFOs.
Yet, Mr. Hoff, you yourself personally, I gather, are certainly willing to accept the notion that there is intelligent life on other worlds
in
other galaxies or somewhere else in ours.
I believe that as soon as you accept the possibility that there could be other inhabitable worlds, you automatically accept the possibility that there could be an infinite number, just as there may be an infinite number of stars in the universe. And therefore, there must be an infinite number of intelligent races and an infinite number of UFOs. I believe that we have just seen the few that happened to pass our way, if I may put it that way.
And that they showed some interest in us.
Apparently, many of these objects have shown a great aversion to coming in contact with us personally, but they apparently have looked us over on the way by.
Okay, Patrick?
Well, do you think that a flying object or the people from other planets, let's say, do you think that they would like to be visible to us, or do you think they would be more sort of shy?
Mister, listen, Patrick, you're going to have to wait a minute for that answer. You're concerned with invisibility, and we're going to get snuffed out here by the FCC if we don't do a couple of things right now. You hang on.